Hi, welcome to Conversations with Musicians with Leia Roseman. In episode 10, season 1, I spoke with the wonderful violinist Aaron Schwebel. He currently holds the positions of concertmaster with the National Ballet of Canada Orchestra and associate concertmaster with the Canadian Opera Company. He's also a member of the Lark Ensemble and the Rosebud String Quartet, and is a founder artistic director of Echo Chamber Toronto, a series that merges chamber music and contemporary dance. In this conversation, we talked about a lot of his experiences growing up in terms of his development and his career and his reflections on this pandemic time. In separate bonus episodes, you can hear him play solo Bach, and we also do a little improv as well as a bonus episode. All of these episodes are available in video format, and the link is in the description. Good morning, Aaron Schwebel. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Leia. Thanks for having me.
So the jobs that you have that pay the bills is that you're concertmaster of the National Ballet Orchestra of Canada and associate concertmaster of the Canadian Opera Company Orchestra.
Yep.
So you spend a lot of time in the pit in a normal year, but not during this pandemic.
Exactly. Yeah, I've come up for air. I spent a lot of time at the Four Seasons Center. We're really lucky. We have an absolutely beautiful hall. Mm-hmm. And I've been there for probably 7 years now. Maybe even 8 at the ballet, at least, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this summer, I believe you have some live chamber music coming up, or maybe not live, but...
It's sort of a... It's something I'm really looking forward to. We've all been waiting for these kind of opportunities, mm-hmm. Performers and audience, and whether or not we'll actually be able to have a live audience is still... to be determined. Everyone's keeping their fingers crossed. But the Ottawa Chamber Fest invited my little series called Echo Chamber Toronto to give a performance, as well as my string quartet, the Rosebud Quartet. So we're coming to Ottawa August 3rd and 4th. We're really excited. We're going to play the Ionescu Octet with the Ironwood Quartet with three dancers, choreographed by Hannah Keel. And then my quartet's going to play some Haydn and Beethoven the next day. We're also playing a fantastic piece by Carmen Braden called The Raven Conspiracy, also choreographed, so we're really looking forward to all that.
So the performance with the Rosebud Quartet is also with the dancers?
No, it's actually just a standalone,
okay.
Two-dimensional performance. But no, I'm kidding.
And you were very involved as a string quartet player in university, more than most people.
Yeah, I loved string quartet. I thought that it would be my career, my future. Mm-hmm. It's as much of my future as my current positions allow. Mm-hmm. But I played in a quartet at McGill University called the Roddick Quartet, named after the Gates, not the tennis player. Mm-hmm. But we actually went to the London Quartet competition in 2009, which was sort of like the big leagues for us because, you know, we were still teenagers at that point, and so we worked furiously and prepared some repertoire for the competition, and I think it was our first kind of real foray into the world of professional string quartets, and we met people who've been doing this for many more years than we had, and we got a glimpse into what kind of life it was, both the good and the bad, like both how incredibly exciting it is and performing in some of the world's greatest halls and with some of the world's greatest musicians. And obviously the repertoire, everyone loves the string quartet repertoire. I mean, we're spoiled for choice. But also like the life of a touring musician can be really challenging. So mm-hmm. So we learned a lot from that experience. And then at Indiana, I played in a group called the Kuttner Quartet, which is it's sort of a rotating door quartet position where quartets audition. And so we did that, and so I felt like I could kind of exercise my quartet muscles a lot in university, which was great.
Did you have experience as a teenager with chamber music before you went to university?
None.
Wow, really? Okay.
None. My first quartet was my first year at McGill University.
Me too, but I thought maybe you were...
No, I was a late bloomer, but I fell in love with it so quickly. It was Opus 18, number 3 was my very first Beethoven. Was my very first string quartet.
When I was at McGill, I remember it must have still been Marcel Saint-Cyr who was the main coach when you were there.
He was still coaching a little bit at McGill, but he was not the main coach. We coached with a few different people. My very first quartet coached with Andrew Dawes, actually. He was a guest faculty at McGill, and we did a lot of coaching with Andre Roy. He was sort of our main coach eventually of the Roddick Quartet. And but I mean, there was such a great faculty at McGill. Like, anyone who we wanted to play for, we could, and we got a lot out of all the various faculty.
It's just when I was there, so it was my first string quartet experience, and he insisted that all of us only play Haydn string quartets for 2 years.
Like, I mean,
it was just great training.
Did you get through all of them?
No, but you weren't allowed to move on. It was very slow progression.
Yeah, of course,
But just all the, it was just an incredible education.
It really is. I still love playing Haydn. The quartet that I play in now, we do a lot of Haydn. It's, and I think people love hearing Haydn. It's kind of got everything. But I remember at McGill, like, the process was really different. Like, we really, really took it apart and really kind of got deep into it. And nowadays, you just don't really have time. You know, you have so many other things to do. But for better and for worse, it's I think in certain senses, it's great to just kind of not overthink that kind of process also.
I want to ask more about the Rosebud Quartet, but I just wanted to circle back to the string quartet competition. I know it was a long time ago, but I'm wondering what you remember of it, like how many quartets, how many days, a little bit about the process.
Do you mean when we started?
No, like at the competition.
It was the Roddick Quartet.
Yeah, I know.
I thought you said Rosebud.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about the Rosebud Quartet, but first I just wanted to circle back to London a long time ago.
We put so many hours into it. I think none of us were really expecting to get in. And when we did, it was sort of like this immense excitement. And also like, okay, we have our work cut out for us. We knew the kind of level of the groups that were going in there. And again, we were 18, 19 years old. So we just kind of put our noses to the grindstone and worked and tried to get the repertoire up to a professional level. And for me, it was my second year playing string quartet, so there was a steep learning curve. But for all of us, there was like that steep learning curve. And so we were like a family back then. We lived, breathed, ate, played together. It was our lives were about that for about 6 months.
And you were still balancing school, or did you lighten your load?
No, we were balancing school. I mean, I don't know if we were balancing it well, but
yeah,
we were doing our best. I think it was just an opportunity that none of us wanted to turn down. It was intense. I think that we got an awful lot out of it. I think we also came away from it knowing that we wanted to have a little bit more balance in our lives. Like, we don't want our lives to be entirely about rehearsing string quartets. As much as we love the music we were playing, it can become like quite unilateral. And I think even as students, we realized we needed balance. And this is a whole segue into another conversation topic, but the subject of competitions in general for people at a young age. And we were not that young, but as a string quartet, we were young. Like, as a string quartet, we were only a year old. And so I think that it's great to have those goals, but framing them in the context of relativity, which is the nature of a competition, can be difficult for organic growth, if you know what I mean. And so that's something I took with me also, was just what kind of environment is the healthiest for growth and learning. And and I think in certain ways, like, seeing other groups who were 5 years ahead of us in that profession was incredibly useful. And there was a lot of good that came out of it. But you know, competitions can reorient your brain in a way that you have to kind of just unravel afterwards, or you know, just remember why you're a musician, remember why you're doing these things, remember, you know, I just kind of have your sights set on your own on your own goals rather than a jury's.
Mm-hmm. And with your quartet now, the Rosebud Quartet, do you all live in Toronto?
Not currently. We've kind of taken turns living outside of Toronto. Right now, our violist, Keith, lives in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. He's accepted a job as principal viola of Edmonton Symphony, but he's taken some leave from his position at the COC, and so we might end up being a long distance quartet, which other groups have done before. So it's in certain ways it's challenging, but you know, we also have another city to go perform in, so that's sort of nice. And besides, we all have orchestral positions, so we're not rehearsing every day anyway.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about balance. So during this pandemic, everything shut down so suddenly, such a shock. So how did that affect you as a musician?
I think all of us were unsure when this was going to end. Yeah. The ambiguity of the timeline really was the thing that was sort of on the top of my mind. What I mean is that if I had known that it was going to last for 3 weeks, mm-hmm. my activity would have been one thing. If I had known it was going to last a year, mm-hmm. you know, I think that because in the beginning it was so unknown, I tried to just kind of occupy my time in a way that was, less goal oriented and more just kind of like maintenance oriented. Like I practiced, I didn't really immediately undertake big projects like mm-hmm. learning a concerto or anything like that. And then as we saw, that this was going to be taking longer and longer to overcome, then I started to think more about, what are those things that I've always wanted to do, but haven't done yet. And then there were the moments where you wondered if we'd ever return back to the hall. And and so I, like many other musicians, started to kind of get my wheels turning about other career possibilities mm-hmm. and whatnot. And so I feel like the pandemic kind of unfolded in three different stages. Like mm-hmm. the first one was just this sort of imposed hiatus. You know, and so it was a time to cook fancy meals, a time to binge watch, you know, your favorite show, a time to catch up with old friends, play some video games, things like that, you know, and obviously practice. But without practicing goals, it was just sort of this like aimless practice where you just played for the sake of playing, and it was really enjoyable.
You say obviously practice, but I don't think all musicians, like I think some people stopped for a while. I didn't, but...
Well, I thought that I was going to have to, like, I originally thought this was going to be 3 weeks, completely naively. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to keep my chops up.
Yeah.
And when it looked like it was going to be, I think it looked like it was going to be 6 to 8 months for some time. I mean, again, this isn't my naive, mm-hmm. completely non-scientific world. And so then the goalposts changed a little bit and
And in terms of maintenance, like as a violinist, do you have go-to routines or did that get changed up?
I am not a typical violinist. Like I don't have etudes or scales that I really do. I sort of spend my time practicing thinking about the concepts and principles of violin playing. Mm-hmm. Like I'll think about technique and posture while I'm playing, but I don't really isolate those principles in an exercise. Mm-hmm. I will, I think there are certain pieces that I practice that just sort of necessitate thinking technically, you know, mm-hmm. And so I devote that time while I'm practicing it. But when I've sort of achieved what I want to achieve, I just try and let that go and just be a musician.
Do you have favorite pieces you like to practice for fun?
If I'm practicing for fun, probably Bach or just some quartet parts, actually. Like I might mm-hmm. pick up a Beethoven quartet and just fiddle around with the violin part.
Yeah. And in your life as a concertmaster, you have, of course, at the beginning especially, there must have been so many notes to learn with all these unfamiliar scores.
Yeah. I mean, the ballet repertoire is huge, especially for concertmaster solos. And so, I kind of had to get my fingers around the Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty. We also do, you know, like Vivaldi, Four Seasons, Prokofiev, First Concerto, and things like that. And so, and I mean, the sky's a limit with dance because choreographers can choreograph anything they want to. And that's sort of what led me to start Echo Chamber, actually, was just imagining certain pieces of music with a physical component. But you never know what's going to pop up in the ballet repertoire. Sometimes it's something you would never expect, and that's one of the perks.
So that piece with the Prokofiev, because we did that in Ottawa with James Ennis, is a pretty young soloist at the time in the pit playing a solo. So you've done that within the
National. Well, I haven't done it with a ballet. I did it with another orchestra just sort of to prepare myself, because I also sometimes the repertoire can come sort of short notice. I mean, obviously there's a period which we won't get it in a shorter period than 60 days, but I, with concertos, I want to have them under my fingers before it's announced. And so I just learned it before, and it hasn't come up since I've been there, but I hope it does.
Yeah. And the Vivaldi Four Seasons, you've played as the soloist?
Yeah. Yeah. We did that a few years ago. That's a James Kudelka ballet. It's fantastic.
Wow. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. It's really beautiful.
And you played with our National Arts Center Orchestra many times in many different capacities. Because when you first started playing with us, I believe you were part of our apprentice program.
Yeah, I was. That was in 2012, and I sat next to Eddie Skerjanc.
Yeah.
And it was great. And then I started subbing, and then I auditioned and was a member for like a couple months before I joined the COC. I mean, you know, I have an absolute huge fondness for the NAC, and anytime I can, I love coming back.
Yeah, and I mean, you've also played guest concertmaster and guest principal second with us, so you've really sat all over the violin section.
Yeah, I took the full tour. Yeah.
And I wanted to ask about your upbringing a little bit. I think you were a singer as well.
Oh, I would never call myself a singer, but I took singing lessons. I was part of a choir. I sang until I was about 13, when my body sort of plunged me into a new register, and and I couldn't really do it anymore, and I just gave up. But I loved singing. Yeah, I sang in the Toronto Children's Chorus, and I had a great singing teacher, Brenda Burge, who encouraged different styles of music also, and so that was really fun.
And I believe you have been pretty serious about a couple of martial arts in your life as well.
I don't know. I mean, relative to people who do this full time, not serious at all, but it's sort of like a hobby sport, I guess. I also haven't done it for a year and a half because of the pandemic, but I was taking Muay Thai classes for about a year and a half or 2 years before the pandemic started. And it was a great, speaking of balance, that was a great balance mechanism in my life, both physically and mentally. It was great to show up somewhere where you have to be more disciplined than in music. Like it was all about discipline, but learning how to move your body in different ways, it's sort of also related to music that way, or to violin. It was great exercise, so I felt more kind of on top of my own life doing that. And it was a really nice community at that gym also. It's called Crudar, and I met a lot of wonderful people there. The coaches were all first rate. And yeah, I really enjoyed it. I miss it a lot. And as soon as we can gather again indoors, I'm going to go. I'm very careful with my hands, though, just for the record.
Yeah. It's hard, you know, as musicians, most musicians I know don't have hobbies. And most of us, it's hard to maintain friendships outside the music world because we have weird schedules. You know,
yeah,
there's a lot of things that are like different. But then we have this wonderful, you know, companionship with musicians all over the place. We have this commonalities that for sure.
We're really lucky. I mean, I don't know other people who go to work and share an office space with some of the people that they're closest to. I mean, some of the people I work with, I've known for most of my life, and I've been through a lot with, and I've shared very meaningful experiences with. And so, on one hand, I mean, it is also your workplace. So it can become like a double dipping, you know, like where it's your social life and also your workplace. And so that's another layer of challenge, I suppose, just to try and compartmentalize. But being able to go to work and see some of those faces is really a luxury, I think.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of the pandemic experience for you and reassessing priorities, how has that affected you?
That's a big question. I think everybody's priorities have shifted. I think I can answer that in two different ways, like personally and professionally. I think professionally, music as my career, as a means of giving people meaningful experiences or either as like a tour guide through these pieces of music or as a an entertainer, you know, there's so many roles that musicians play.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the most important thing is that you connect with the people you're playing for. And I think that it's now we sort of have to really think more about how that's done. I think the concert experience is going to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the music that people want to hear is going to change. And so I've been trying to keep my radar open, my ears open, and just sort of think a little bit about what kind of experience I can proctor as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of what you're asking about?
These are open questions.
Very open-ended. Open-ended.
Yeah.
Okay. Personally, I've felt really I feel like in this pandemic it's been an opportunity to become closer with the people who I care about.
Mm-hmm.
And not that I wasn't before, but it was sort of like a fill in the cracks sort of thing. Like, and not by design either. It's sort of like when you're in the prime of your career, like you say yes to everything. Mm-hmm. and you can become a little bit narrow-minded about not narrow-minded, but like with blinders on, just about sort of diving headfirst into every project you can. At least I dive headfirst into a lot of things, and I think being able to have time to spend with my family, my partner, my dog, you know, just like unscheduled time has been something I really want to prioritize more.
Mm-hmm.
Also just to, like, we haven't been able to travel at all, but
mm-hmm.
I've been able to travel in my own city, and like that's been really nice because I didn't do as much of that before the pandemic.
Yeah, just appreciating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. We live in a very work-oriented society, which is not, that's not a criticism. I mean, people have to work, you know? But I think that there's also this fear that if you kind of stop doing things, you're going to be forgotten about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's sort of a little bit universal in the music world. Like relevance is important to all of us. And I think that being able to let go of that is a good thing. And it's sort of, it's a gift to yourself. I think that sounds really cheesy, but it's true.
During the last few months, I've been in contact with a lot of adult amateurs, some of them new to violin and some of them coming back to it or who kept playing through other careers. And it's very inspiring because I think music has meant so much to many of us during this time when we can't hear music live, but to be able to make music yourself is so great. And I believe you've been involved with a couple of festivals which combine professionals and amateurs together.
Yeah. The Toronto Summer Music Festival has a community academy. Mm-hmm. People who play, they use the word amateur, or maybe, anyway, the word amateur is sort of like a coverall. Some people play at a very high level. Mm-hmm. Some people are not as advanced, but it's a space for people whose main career is not in music to come.
Yeah, that's what I mean by amateur. They're not.
Yeah. But I mean, some of these guys can really, really play. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's really impressive and very humbling. And also I went to the St. Lawrence Academy, the St. Lawrence String Quartet Academy once, and they had a component also for adult amateurs. And it's wonderful. It's a really great environment to connect with people who have music in their life and who share that common, upbringing, I guess, but who've gone in different directions. And I think one of the things that is really still prevalent in the music world is this idea that you have to be only a musician, you know? And I think these people show us that that's not true. You can be whatever you want to be and also a musician. Mm-hmm. Just because it's not the thing that is paying the bills does not make you less of a musician. And so that's really neat to be able to interface with people who've gone down those paths. I think a lot of people in the pandemic have done that also. Like, I think that right now we're redefining what it means to be a professional musician. It doesn't mean it's your single professional activity. Mm-hmm. Especially for people who, I mean, as orchestral musicians, we have the luxury of a full-time job or like a position, you know, that's stable. But if you're a freelancer, if you don't belong to an institution or an organization, then you're not tethered to anything, so why not take on more, you know? And it doesn't make you any less of a musician to have multiple vocations.
Mm-hmm. And when you were a student, were there summer festivals you attended that really had an impact on your growth?
Yeah, I would say probably the two that come to mind are NYO and Domaine Forget's Chamber Music Session. I think those really defined me as a musician and also what I love, what I strive to have in my life. NYO is such a powerful social experience that, also just like the grandeur of orchestra. Like NYO was my first orchestra, actually. So it was my first time sitting among so many other musicians, and it was a rush. Like, it was constantly buzzing. I mean, the music was amazing. The experience was so intense and exciting that the music kind of, like, became about that experience. And it made me really enjoy orchestra. Mm-hmm. Just being able to connect with so many people at once. Mm-hmm. And Domaine Forget's Chamber Music Session was just really all about the music, and it's such a beautiful place in Charlevoix, Quebec. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, late nights reading quartets and drinking whiskey in the barn, it's really fun. And it's some of the most joyous memories I have playing music. And so those really stayed with me. Mm-hmm. And realized, like, how great a life as a musician can be. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, obviously, as you get older, like, you're no longer a student, your life has more responsibilities and such. Like, it becomes a job like any other, and I think the challenge is to retain the thing that makes you love it and that makes you feel alive, because that's why we go into music.
Yeah,
that's why I went into music.
Of course, yeah. And actually, I mean, coming back to the pit, people may not realize, like, how often do you play the Nutcracker Ballet, let's say, every Christmas season?
26 is, I think, the number Yeah. It's a lot. It's
It's a
yeah,
lot.
it's a workout. And I think like the like Nutcracker season is very challenging. You know, in some ways it's very easy because you know the piece by memory after a few years, you know, and but it's challenging to show up in the pit with a fresh conscience and a fresh attitude. And not just treat it like, you know, okay, I'm brushing my teeth or something that you do every day, because, you know, you want to give people the experience that like maybe it's their first Nutcracker, or maybe it's their first time ever hearing an orchestra, or maybe, you know, and I mean, we're also not necessarily the main event, you know, that like everyone knows the music and it's an inextricable part of the, is that the right word? Part of the production. But we're not on stage, so it's even easier to kind of lose sight of the audience and why they're there. But yeah, it's tough. I usually try and take a few off just to stay fresh.
Yeah. I was also curious. We have just a couple parallels in our lives because we both went to McGill University, then we both went to Indiana University for our master's. I found it a real culture shock coming from this vibrant city of Montreal, going to Bloomington. And it was such a different music school as well. How did you find that transition?
It's a good question. I think I, The environments were certainly different. I think when I was a student at McGill, I felt like I was really living in Montreal. And when I was a student at Indiana, I didn't really feel like I was living in Bloomington. I felt like I was at like a boarding school. Like, you know, it was like just a huge university. And like my day to day was just being surrounded by other students and teachers. And at when I was at McGill, my day to day often was just as a civilian of the city. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they were both really pivotal, I'd say, for different reasons.
Well, when I was at McGill, I mean, things might have changed because we're different generations, but like the orchestra had a real sense of camaraderie. It was like McGill, you know, Symphony, it was like big deal. Everyone was in it. But then when I went to Indiana, there were like seven orchestras and it seemed kind of random, you know?
Yeah, that's true. It's sort of like a bit more of a factory that way, but yeah, I played in the chamber orchestra at Indiana, so I escaped a little bit of the big factory orchestras, but yeah, I don't know. I only played in the orchestra for a year actually, because we did the quartet after. But yeah, there were a lot of violinists at Indiana. I don't think I met all of them.
I think there was 270 or so when I was there. And speaking of students, so you do a little bit of adjudication and master classes and that sort of thing, or do you also teach regularly private students? I can't imagine you have time.
I do actually. I've never had more than two students at a time, but I love teaching and I'd actually love to teach more, but I don't think I'll ever teach a ton of students just because, unless I make some career changes. It does take a ton of focus, and currently I have one student, and he's a very talented young violinist, and I dedicate a lot of energy and thought and time to it. So it's beyond the time. I mean, teaching is it goes beyond the time that you actually spend with a student,
That's right, yeah.
as you know. But yeah, I give master classes when I'm asked to or adjudicate, and it's really nice to connect with musicians of that age, of that generation, and to be able to offer them something from my life, from my experience. Yeah, it means a lot to me to be able to, you know, send the elevator back down.
That definitely. And do you find there's some pieces of advice that keep coming back whenever you're doing these master classes or adjudications?
I think that it really depends on the student. Some students need to hear different things. Some students need to focus more. Some students need to zoom out a bit and try to enjoy what they're doing a little bit more. It's really hard to just kind of streamline advice to young people. I think everyone is different. Everyone's needs are different. I mean, just thinking back to my own education, I remember when I was 15 or 16, I definitely needed to focus more. Mm-hmm. But when I was 22, I needed to chill out more and just, you know, and so like it's always shifting when you're a student, and also as a professional, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. this pandemic definitely did that to me and other people. Just, it definitely reorients your priorities. And for students, sometimes you don't even know if it's what you want to do full time. And so, I think the big question is, what role do these people want, do these young people want music to take in their lives? And so I try to guide them towards that, mm-hmm. Towards, being able to make their own decisions about that. And also offer any, advice along the way. I mean, that's just about the life end of it, not the actual violin mm-hmm. end of it. But I learned a lot from playing with other people. So usually that comes up a lot in master yeah. classes. Just learning how to listen is a huge skill. Mm-hmm. It's something that you don't really learn until you play with other people. How can you, you know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, learning how to listen to other people while giving your best is I think what chamber music or any ensemble is really all about. And knowing what your role is within that ensemble, like sometimes you have to lead, sometimes you have to be led. And so that's something that I think you really learn from experience. And so I usually spend a lot of time encouraging people to have those experiences.
Mm-hmm. Well, and very soon people can hear your chamber music. So thanks so much for joining me today. It was really interesting talking to you.
My pleasure. I'm happy to talk with you, Leah.
Hope to see you again in person soon.
Yeah, definitely. Have a great summer.
Yeah. Season 1 of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season 2 continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.